and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
If you're like me, you've gotten one or two text messages and emails and even phone calls hitting you up for money. And love it or hate it, money is the mother's milk of politics. In Pennsylvania and nationally, we're seeing record amounts of money raised and, for that matter, records already spent. Federal candidates just filed their Q2 data with the Federal Election Commission, the FEC. This is really an important snapshot for Pennsylvania politicos to unpackage. Pre and post primary, we can see the strength and the organizational infrastructure of these campaigns through the finance data. So we're sitting down with Kat McParland today for a behind the scenes crash course in campaign finance. She has a world of experience working with local, state, and federal candidates. Okay, Kat McParland, welcome to my kitchen table.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Kat, you've had a whirlwind year. Looking back to last July, tell folks a little about the fun and adventures that you had over the last year.
Sure. So I last year joined Malcolm Kenyatta's campaign for U.S. Senate. We had a fantastic campaign there and worked with some great people. And when that came to an end in May, I have started my own consulting services. So I've been able to work with some great people like Councilmember Helen Gim and Congresswoman Mary Gay Scanlon. So it's been a whirlwind, like you said, of a year, but I feel very lucky to have worked for some amazing people.
So Kat, we have amazing listeners. I don't really know them. I just hear anecdotally, but anecdotally, I hear we have a lot of students. And I think that, and for that matter, a lot of activists, and then we certainly have a lot of candidates. The candidates and their staff and their family are deeply familiar with campaign finance. Whereas volunteers and activists, when they think of campaigns, they think maybe more of door knocking and rallies and what have you. So I guess my question to start off our discussion, Kat, is how did you get involved in campaign finance? Because it is kind of behind the scenes from the broader public.
It is, definitely. I was working as an intern when I was a senior in college at St. Joe's. I was working as an intern in Montgomery County on Josh Shapiro's race at the time for Montgomery County Commissioner. He was going through that reelection. And when I graduated, it lined up with his beginning of the campaign for his race for attorney general. So the amazing people that Josh Shapiro has surrounding him, one of the best campaign teams, I think, in the nation. I was lucky enough for them to take me on as a finance assistant. And I just really was able to learn kind of great systems of how to raise money for incredible candidates. So from there, I joined Bob Casey's campaign for re-election in 2018 before moving to a municipal race, city commissioner race in Philadelphia with Khalil Williams, where we ended up breaking campaign raising records for that race. Then I head back to Montgomery County and worked as a finance director for that slate of folks running there in 2019. And then I joined the Democratic Party as the finance director right before the pandemic hit. So we tried to raise as much money as we could for the state party during the pandemic and the lockdown. And then from there, I went to Malcolm. So it's sort of been a crazy packed 6 years of constant work, but I've been extremely lucky to have been in the positions I have been in.
I'm just curious, a lot to unpackage there. But so when you enrolled at St. Joe's, did you already have the political bug, or were you still kind of figuring out, you know, what happens when you grow up?
Oh, I had no idea. I transferred to St. Joe's, actually. So it was my second go at a college. I thought I wanted to do communications. I'd always loved watching the news and I liked politics, but it's never something I saw myself working in. So just through doing a bunch of different internships that I did in different industries and decided I didn't like, the last internship I hadn't done really was work in a campaign. And so it ended up that I always say like I tripped and fell into this, but I just caught the bug for it. And it's been kind of a constant cycle ever since.
That's great. I mean, so I should have said instead of a whirlwind year, you've had a whirlwind like 5+ years, if I'm doing my math correctly. So I was excited for this conversation for lots of reasons as we're dissecting the FEC numbers that have just come out. So those are the federal numbers. But you have perspective on non-federal, which is in Pennsylvania, the world unto itself. It's limitless. And hopefully you can explain that. But then also the city of Philadelphia, my understanding, has its own campaign finance. So if you could speak, because I don't want to assume listeners know, to the differences of the three.
Sure, absolutely. So federal and municipal races have limits. At least in Pennsylvania, municipal races have limits. Statewide races, for example, the governor or state houses have unlimited resources, unlimited. So for the city of Philadelphia, this cycle, it will be, you can spend or someone can donate up to $3,100 for that race. Current federal race, John Fetterman's race, an individual in the general can spend or donate $2,900. But if you wanted to donate to Josh Shapiro and you happen to have $250,000, you are more than welcome to do that. So there's different restrictions just depending on the level of race.
And we increasingly have listeners all around the country, but specifically in New York, Virginia, DC, Maryland. What, when it comes to corporations, because I know every state's different, I don't want to assume people know. So
sure.
This is, you said individuals, did you mean individuals or can
yes, corporate that was entities? Yeah, individuals are those limits that I just mentioned, but corporations, they need a PAC in order to donate. Corporate dollars themselves can't be accepted, but if they have a PAC, they're able to donate. I believe it's still up to $5,000 per federal candidate in the general. In the city of Philadelphia, a PAC can donate up to $12,600. And then again, in that statewide race, and it's been a while since I worked in just a statewide race, but I believe that's also, there's no cap on that as well from a PAC. But if I'm wrong, I will fact check myself.
So, I mean, maybe I shouldn't phrase it as favorite, but I mean, it's a completely different approach to fundraising for the candidate and then for the candidate's right hand, like yourself, when you could approach someone for six figures versus these capped limits. So, I mean, how as you take a look at this, both for your clients and then your past employers, I mean, how do you map this out?
So for a statewide race, it's every fundraiser's dream, because if you receive a check for six figures, it's, your heart just like skips a beat and it feels incredible. At the same time, I've always loved working within limits, whether that's municipal or federal, because I think it does give the fundraiser and the team and to some extent the candidate this level of creativity. And that just leads to bringing more folks into the fold who aren't typically political donors. So for example, when we see or talk about an increase of grassroots online donations, sometimes these are folks who have never given before. They don't really know how this whole political campaign thing works. But because there's only so many dollars you can get from the usual suspects, it really allows for this creativity of expanding the donor pool, which I think is a really exciting challenge.
So my team this week told me, Kat, that we actually have two regular listeners in Iceland. I don't know who they are, but if I know how to say hello in Iceland, then I would. The reason I mention this is because if you're not in Iceland and you're a U.S. citizen, you probably have received a text message or an email completely unsolicited from a candidate. And you kind of touched on that. But over the 5, 6, 7 years that you've been in this business, this has all evolved. So I think it'd be helpful for listeners if you could speak to these smaller dollar online, which I guess don't really take a lot of the candidate or the staff's time and potentially could yield quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, digital fundraising has become an incredible resource for candidates and its own entity. I think when I started all of this 6, 7 years ago, the digital fundraising department usually fell under the finance department, the fundraising department. Digital now tends to be its own department in a campaign. There'll be a digital director for a campaign, and they do all the things, you know, that involve comms and posting things online and all those organizational aspects. But there's also a huge, just growing, ever-evolving field of using digital outreach, whether it be text, social media, email, to really raise money for candidates and campaigns. which I really do think John Fetterman's team not only is excelling in right now, but they kind of saw the potential of this exploding new way to raise money and have really, you know, harnessed that in an exciting way.
And I guess also if you could just speak mechanically, obviously every campaign is different, but by and large, for better or worse, the fundraising is driving the schedule. But for the rare candidate that can figure out how to send an email at 6 a.m., then maybe the rest of their day is somewhat flexible and they don't need to physically go to an event.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain level of privilege of not having to do the regular fundraising motifs that are in most campaigns. So for example, we use John Fetterman, who's our candidate for the Democratic Party here in Pennsylvania. He has built such an extensive network and a really strong grassroots online network that he may not have to do as much call time as a candidate for city council running for the first time in Philadelphia may have to do. And so while there's all these new exciting developments in digital fundraising, there are also things like events, making calls or dialing for dollars, all of those tried and true methods that, you know, less established candidates really need to do in order to achieve that groundwork of having an excellent, you know, online digital fundraising base.
Well, I know we have a lot of first-time candidates who listen to this show and certainly aspiring candidates. And, you know, I think too often people think there's a magic list that if I just had this email list or I just had these people's phone numbers. So maybe if you could speak to that, because you know, you did allude to just the mechanics of how money gets in the bank.
Absolutely. And for any first-time candidates listening, thank you for running. We need you. But yeah, I think you touched on something really important is that fundraising is daunting and there's no, you know, one set playbook for how to raise. That being said, I love doing workshops that help people maximize their networks. But yeah, there is no one master list. For first-time candidates, I think the best thing to do is Rolodex yourself, is go for those, what they call low-hanging fruit donors and people who know you and believe in you, regardless of what you're running for. So for example, I worked with Khalil Williams, who ran for city commissioner, never ran for anything before, and you know was really coming with little fundraising experience for himself. And so just taking his network, finding the people who didn't know what a city commissioner was, but knew who Khalil was and wanted to invest in his future and his campaign is a great place to start. And then you can kind of go out from there. If you're running on a healthcare platform, there might be healthcare groups around the state, the Commonwealth, that are interested in what you have to say and what your background is, what your advocacy issues are. So it's a lot of groundwork, especially for candidates who may not be able to afford to pay staff. So they're going off of volunteers or just their own work. So it can be a little daunting when you get started, but there's always people in your network who they just don't realize that they want to be donors yet.
So we're talking about the month of April, the month of May, and the month of June. So every federal candidate across the country has these set fundraising quarters where they need to post for the world to see, meaning their opponents and the media, these numbers. And the numbers do tell a story. I think you can kind of work backwards. So, yeah, Kat, if you can explain a bit more about that for specifically the Fetterman for Senate campaign.
Absolutely. So John Fetterman's campaign has released some incredible numbers showing that he has raised the most out of any Pennsylvanian who has run for Senate here, which is incredible. Their individual donations also speak to that grassroots digital effort that we were speaking about earlier. And I think there's been a lot of comparison, too, in the media drawn between Senator Casey's race in 2018 and John Fetterman's campaign right now in 2020. And there are definitely similarities, but I think there are so many differences as well that contribute to such a boom in fundraising.
Well, can we tease that out? Because, you know, that midterm in 2018 on so many levels is radically different than what we're dealing with in less than 115 days. You know, what similarities, what differences when it comes to the fundraising and how the money's coming in?
115 days. Who's counting? but I think similarities are both they're running during non-presidential election years. They're both running during gubernatorial election years. The differences there being that, you know, Senator Casey was running with an incumbent governor in Tom Wolf. John Fetterman's off, obviously running with an open governor's seat here, Josh Shapiro and Doug Mastriano. So the stakes are a little bit higher there. I also think, you know, in Senator Casey's race in 2018, there was no, for lack of a better term, there was no quote unquote villain. Of course, he was running against Lou Barletta, but as diplomatically as I can phrase it, Lou Barletta wasn't exactly galvanizing the Republican base. Senator Casey was, you know, has been in office for a very long time and had garnished a lot of support from Republicans and Democrats. In this case, Fetterman has this opportunity to have this quote unquote villain in Dr. Oz, which anytime you can have a villain to fundraise against, it is huge for fundraising potential. I think comms, it gets a little bit dicier about how you message, but for fundraising, when they have clear stakes to raise against, that's always helpful. So when you can say the other guy, you know, doesn't even live here in Pennsylvania, or he's this doctor, but he supports these unsubstantiated scientific claims, that's helpful to fundraising as well. And I want to make clear, by no means does this diminish the efforts of the Fetterman fundraising department. I mean, they have done incredible work and maximized, I think, the potential of every dollar. But I do think those differences mark or explain why the fundraising is so much higher this quarter for John Fetterman than it was in the respective quarter for Senator Casey.
So moving to probably the most purple part of a purple state, Congresswoman Wild's district, primarily in the Lehigh Valley, we're seeing that she had the best quarter of her reelection, $1 million plus. I imagine when political dorks like you and me unpackaged this, a lot came in the final week. So, I mean, to what extent, when you look back over all these campaigns, to moments, in this particular instance, we're talking about the Supreme Court's decision, but, you know, to moments, news hooks drive the fundraising?
Absolutely. The overturning of Roe v. Wade from the Supreme Court has been, on one hand, the most devastating move in a lot of our lifetimes politically. On this other hand, there's again this notion of the villain. And I think, especially as a female candidate in an area that is rather purple, so many folks, so many women, even if they aren't necessarily consistent Democrat, see the threat of that to their daily lives. And so to be able to use that notion, which is very real, that Pennsylvania needs to keep every seat we have, especially in purple areas, and needs to turn over red to blue seats, I think people are really buying in literally to supporting candidates and supporting incumbents who have shown a track record of protecting, at very least, the healthcare options of the folks around them. So in purple areas, while they're not a lock for Democrats, I think this, all of the political turmoil that has been going on have made these stakes less of a talking point and more of a reality. So I think that could play into a lot of her fundraising success.
Yeah, Kat, you alluded to this earlier. So to what extent, and it was in the context of an incumbent governor versus an open seat, a non-presidential year, to what extent have you found that political money is fungible? Meaning you're working for great candidates and theoretically, some of the candidates we've mentioned are calling and knocking on the same doors. So I certainly have been hit up by multiple candidates over the last month. So, I mean, is this fungible or do you find that a lot of candidates have a distinct donor pool?
I think it's both. I think a lot of candidates have their tried and true donor base, folks who have been with them since the beginning or know them personally. But I do think there has been this expansion of donor pools, kind of this more crossing over of groups than we've previously seen. And I think this kind of speaks more to this macro notion of going from more of an institutional fundraising method and going into a more progressive fundraising method. I think in the past, and potentially even when I started not that long ago, there were some folks that you would look at and say, oh, they're never going to give to X. They only give to Y. That's changed over time. And that might have something to do with the ever-growing interests that fall under this Democratic Party ideal. But I do think there also is an increased amount of donor fatigue. There's an increased amount of people saying, take me off this list. And so it presents an opportunity, but also a challenge.
You're talking to one of those fatigued donors. but if I understood you correctly, candidates should not assume a one-for-one crossover. So let's say there's an organization that cares deeply about fill in the blank, and it's a nonprofit, and your contribution's a tax write-off versus a candidate who also espouses those positions.
Right, exactly. And there's definitely crossover between the worlds of issue advocacy or nonprofit and political. But yes, I think a fallacy of fundraising is all in assumption. And so even if someone's given to you in the past and you're a candidate, if they're focused on one issue area, whether that's, U.S. and Israel relations or, pro-choice, pro-life debate, if you don't keep that relationship up and maintain that donor relationship, you might lose that donor over time.
I wasn't going to ask this. I hadn't thought about it, but it's always been in the back of my mind that every single nonprofit that my family supports, they have a development director. And maybe it sounds like semantics, but I've never engaged with a campaign that views it as development. It's essentially, when can I shake down Ari and when can I do it again? And it's a different way of thinking, right? And I guess because campaigns have a shelf life.
Exactly. I think the earnestness of us finance directors and fundraisers for political causes, it is because there's only so long to raise a certain amount of money. And with each cycle, with each year, that amount of money that you need to raise goes up and up and up. But it is funny to think about the different semantics and terms that, in the nonprofit world, it's a development director. In the political world, campaign world, it's finance director. But sometimes people think, oh, finance, accounting, you went to business school. Finance in political world means fundraising. So it's a world unto itself with all of these different words that describe kind of the same thing, but there's just so many different rules that fall under political, nonprofit, corporate, all of those things.
You've been very, very generous with your time. I want to touch on something that you alluded to. Do you have a rule of thumb? Let's say one of your candidates calls half a dozen times, and this potential donor just does not return the call. At that point, do you say no or, the Supreme Court decision happened or something happened? I mean, at what point do you kind of move on to potentially greener pastures?
Sure. So I think my rule with call time, at least, is that, I think it takes an average, and this might be different now because I learned it a million years ago, but it takes an average of 3 touches to know when a person is done. So if you leave a voicemail and email 3 times over the course of 2 or 3 months and there's just no response, then I say, let's cycle in some other people. Let's leave them kind of out of it. But at the same time, I think there is something to be said about re-engagement, something that gets left out of fundraising sometimes, especially for larger campaigns, is this notion of saying, well, we have the donation, now we can just move on. I think it's really important to keep people engaged, to have, semi-regular, maybe quarterly check-ins with your donors, whether that's a newsletter or a Zoom call, to keep them updated on what their donation has meant to the campaign. So I think, you don't want to be the person who keeps knocking on the same door 17 times. Sometimes you need to get the hint. But when you do get a donation from someone, making sure that they are continuously put into the fold, they know what's going on, and they know their donation wasn't just, lost in the breeze.
Okay, so as listeners unpackage these FEC numbers from around the country, but probably most likely from around Pennsylvania, what surprises do you think they're going to find? What should they specifically be looking for?
I think definitely looking for the types of PACs, the types of interest groups that might donate to campaigns. I think this is more interesting on the Republican side because the Republican candidates tend to kind of just accept a wider variety of potentially detrimental PACs, whether it's environmental PACs or anti-pro-choice PACs. I think that's always interesting to see. Something else I would look for, which is becoming increasingly important, and usually this is put out by the campaigns, but the amount of individual donors, the average contribution to a campaign. I think John Fetterman's team said it was somewhere around $40 was the average contribution per person. That can also show just the widespread support that a candidate has. So something else might be also looking at all the different states that money comes into from around the country for these races, especially since Pennsylvania is going to be a top tier Senate race, if not the top tier Senate race, and then the top tier gubernatorial race. You know, there's a lot at stake in a state like Pennsylvania. So I think all eyes are going to be on this Commonwealth, and it'll be a very interesting round of FEC reports going forward.
So final question, Kat. You've been super generous with your time. It used to be that it was a bit of a horse race for insiders, and journalists would always report on, oh my gosh, you know, this candidate raised twice as much, or this candidate has twice as much in the bank. But now we're seeing all these quote unquote dark money expenditures. So I don't want to minimize our discussion. I think it's been a great discussion over the last half hour, but you know, how do you think all that money factors into the picture that people will look at this week in the FEC reports?
Well, so it's very interesting in the FEC reports that are going to be coming out now because they include part of pre-primary and part of the general. I think individual donations are always going to be the bread and butter of these campaigns. But I think you're exactly right. These independent expenditures, which for anyone who might not know what that is, are groups that are unaffiliated with the campaign and do not communicate with the campaign, but can spend money and raise money to have commercials on TV, advertisements, spend either for or against your candidate. They play a huge role, and I think they play a huge role in why it is so expensive to run for office, why every cycle it gets, oh my gosh, it just gets exponentially more expensive, especially when you're looking at these statewide and federal races. So it will be interesting to keep an eye on what those IEs are, who they're spending for, who they're spending against. But I expect we can see a lot of them, especially in this senatorial race.
Yeah, you just alluded to it, and I don't know if we're ending on a high note with this, but Philadelphia, I believe, is the third most expensive television market across all 50 states. And we always used to joke that you get three for the price of one. You get a good chunk of Pennsylvania voters, but you also get a good chunk of Delaware and New Jersey voters at that, too. So, Kat, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for the work you're doing in the trenches.
Thank you so much. This was such an awesome opportunity.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too, at PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week.